Well met, and welcome to episode 162 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for January 7th, 2018. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Happy New Year. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this return to podcasting, we are back from a really long hiatus. 3 months as I was subbing at Camarillo High School, but more on that in a minute. In this podcast, we're going to make up for some lost time. We're going to start off with an overview of the Tempests that are available on video, a look at two speeches by Caliban, and a podcasting preview. Okay. So why I've been gone so long. For those of you who don't read the blog, and shame on you if you don't, I spent two of the last 3 months subbing in a high school English classroom at one of the local campuses. Now, as you probably know, I taught a long, long, long time ago. You can check out some of the very early blog entries from nearly a decade ago for details on that portion of the tale, but I gave it all up to hit the private sector. When a long-term contract died a while back, I started to reconsider a return to the classroom, and as luck would have it, this long-term subbing gig fell into my lap in late September. I looked at it as kind of an interview, only I was interviewing teaching to see if I wanted to let it back into my life. Long story short, it was a great 2 months. I certainly didn't hate it, and honestly, not to wax too ickily sentimental or nostalgic or anything, it kind of gave me a sense of purpose that I had been missing. I've decided that later this spring, I'll be applying for full-time teaching gigs. And then I'll be...
I'm back in the saddle again. Out where a friend is a friend. Where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly Jameson weed. I'm back in the saddle again.
Now let's kick this off by taking a look at some of the video versions of The Tempest available out there. Starting off, we have The Tempest from BBC's Complete Works, an entry from 1980. As part of the second season of the series, and the last with original producer Cedric Messina in charge, John Gorey, who had directed Twelfth Night earlier in the season, and some of the first season of Doctor Who nearly 2 decades earlier, mounted a production in late 1979 with a broadcast early the next year. He cast Michael Horndon as Prospero. We've seen Horndon quite a bit in this series. Lear, Capulet in Romeo and Juliet, LeFou in All's Well That Ends Well, even Jupiter in Cymbeline, and he's always been solid. But more importantly, at least for me, was Gorey's casting of the visuals. Greater use of handheld camera in the opening scene creates this great sense of confusion, and then we see Prospero on the cliff. And Gorey gives us this incredibly neat, rocky set. Beautiful, not realistic per se, but perfect for this magical play. Not as perfect are the depictions of the magic itself. The production is filled with superimpositions, which for the time, I suppose, was television par for the course. The effects were created by the BBC originally for their use in the Doctor Who series. Maybe this was why Gorey got the nod. But they feel incredibly dated today. Also problematic was the visuals regarding the non-human character. Ariel is a bronze, near-naked, effeminate male, while Caliban looks like a bizarre Bigfoot clone. There's some interesting directorial decisions with this Sasquatch, however. The camera, while not subjective to Caliban, does seem to often place him in the foreground of Prospero. Not quite sure what this is supposed to mean, but it was interesting. As was his seeming love for Miranda, so that when he tells his new masters that they can bed her, it feels like a scorned lover trying to make his ex suffer. The play itself is relatively short, but with the songs and dances in the play, it runs nearly 2.5 hours. And even the seeming comedy, with Caliban and the drunks, or between Prospero and Miranda, is dry and humorous. The delivery of the two major speeches are less powerful as well. the Our Revels speech. He was incredibly vexed and angry, which makes sense, but there's no sense of the wistfulness that is often seen. And this lack of wistfulness extends to the epilogue. So if this sounds like I'm ambivalent about this one, you're absolutely right. Should you see it? Sure. Yeah, I guess. But mainly because after this one, I'm concerned that the play may be a tough nut to crack on film. We shall see. Next up, we have a 1983 video production starring Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. Now, confession time. My first Tempest was a live production that had Stephanie Zimbalist, Ephraim's daughter, as Miranda. That production holds a special place in my heart. 4 years later, her father, whom I had watched in the old television series The FBI when I was a kid, would take on the role of Prospero in a production that is part of the Bard Productions series, which all take place on the same faux globish set. This production does not hold a special place in my heart. Maybe it's the fact that this is the first video I've watched in a long time because of my sub hiatus, or maybe it's just bad. The piece is directed by William Woodman, who had done a couple of more of these Bard productions. I'm not sure how much of his direction is in the visual capture of the play versus the acting of the original production, if there was one. Regardless, when compared to Julie Taymor, this feels bland, almost pedestrian. It's very stagey and never really takes flight. Zimbalist gives an interesting performance. He's understandable, meaning we get an idea of the meaning of the words, and it seems he knows what they mean, not something that can be said for much of the rest of the cast. But his gestures, very actory. Woodman might have done well to hand out Hamlet's advice to the players during rehearsals. And he's almost too spry. His reading of the Our Revels Now Have Ended speech is good, insightful, but it doesn't seem to fit the scene itself. The actress who plays Miranda overacts. Ariel overgestures like his master. Caliban appears more like Oscar the Grouch meets insane homeless man, and I never bought for a minute that Ferdinand understood what he was saying. And add to this a Trinculo played by TV's Horshack from Welcome Back, Cotter, and it's obvious that the acting didn't work for me. The play's structural problems, long scenes, are not helped by the production's slow pacing. Nor is the play serviced well by one of the worst jump cuts I've ever seen. The banquet for the shipwrecked royals turns into skulls in an almost laughably ridiculous cutaway to their reactions and then back to the table. Like I said, Zimbalist isn't bad, but he's not enough to recommend this. But it does make me wonder what a production with him and his daughter would have been like. Then, there doesn't seem to be much for nearly 30 years. But then, in 2010, as part of Canada's Stratford Shakespeare Festival, Des McAniff directed Christopher Plummer as Prospero in a well-received production, which was subsequently captured for video release. Look, if I was somewhat, well, completely ambivalent about the BBC Complete Works entry, there's actually no hedging or qualifications here. This is one I can get behind completely. The film/play begins simply enough. A blue childlike sprite descends seemingly in water, or do I think that only because she's blue, to retrieve a book on the floor of the ocean? Then we hear Miranda's cry of father just as we're thrown into the chaos aboard the ship. I'm not sure if it's this use of the camera and its angles, but it looks as if the stage itself is moving up and down. Occasionally during the scene, we hear Miranda call out for her father. It's a nice touch. When we finally meet them, they appear more ramshackle than the beautifully dressed pair in the BBC version. Her dress is not quite completely put together, though by the end, better garments do appear on them. Magic? And his magic garment looks like it was made out of seaweed. This run-down appearance adds to the sense of familial familiarity and love between the two. When she says his tale could cure deafness, they share a laugh together. Plummer's Prospero's relationship with the island's two other inhabitants is a bit more troubled, as they should be. Ariel, that blue sprite from the beginning, is more than a child, a teen perhaps, and not Prospero's, so there's a tension there, with a feeling of underlying love as well. Caliban, truly a hodgepodge of animals, is obviously more antagonistic, as is rightfully so, as this was his island. He revels in his memory of his attempted rape of Miranda, and you've got to think that he doesn't consider it rape. McAnuff does some interesting things with the concept of observation. We observe Caliban observing Ariel and Prospero observing Ferdinand. This kind of layering and the mix of objectivity, we see each, and subjectivity, we know that each is being seen and sees the scene differently, somehow makes the play work better, giving it a more story-like, fable-like vibe, perfect for a play with magic and beasts. This is the most humorous version of The Tempest that I can remember. There's quite a bit of humor in the Teller production a few years back, if memory serves, but that seemed more wistful. Here, the interplay is funny, not only between father and daughter, but between Caliban and his two new masters, Stefano and Trinculo, who are presented like actual Elizabethan clowns. When Ferdinand comes onto stage carrying his wood, it is the most ridiculously large log you've ever seen. It's just fun and funny. Across the board, McAniff's actors are excellent. Plummer is very good, as is Trish Lindstrom as Miranda. And as I've noted, there is wonderful interplay between them. Gareth Potter as Ferdinand is perfectly earnest and handsome, and Dion Johnston and Juliana Soelistio make for great Caliban and Ariels, respectively. If you can get a hold of this, I got it through my local library, and I believe you can rent it off of YouTube. This is definitely one I think you should check out, at least in comparison to the BBC one. In that same year, we get a purely cinematic version, shot on location as opposed to on a soundstage or a stage set. And this is the 2010 cinematic theatrical release directed by Julie Taymor and starring Helen Mirren as Prospera. This cinematic aspect is a double-edged sword. On one hand, it does afford Taymor to bring in some pretty impressive talent. Beyond the aforementioned Mirren, we get Ben Winshaw as Ariel, Jimon Honshu as Caliban, Felicity Jones as Miranda, David Strathairn as Alonzo, Chris Cooper as Antonio, Alan Cumming as Sebastian, Alfred Molina as Stefano, and Russell Brand as Trinculo. And all of them acquit themselves admirably. On the flip side, it also allows the filmmakers to really push the magic elements of the play via computer-generated imagery, and some of it's pretty cool. I especially liked the opening image of an island-like sandcastle melting into the hand of Miranda as the film's titular storm rains down. But I do have in my notes, around the time of the masks in the play's later half, CG goes apeshit, and I'm not kidding. It's just unnecessary. I mean, I get the desire to do some visual magic, but at some point you've got to ask yourself, does the play need this? Does the text support this? And if the answer is no, and you still do it, well, it just begins to feel kind of masturbatory. Anyway, let's focus on the positives. The idea of Prospero as a woman, I think, is brilliant. The change of gender has repercussions throughout the interactions, both with Miranda and the other two inhabitants of the island, Ariel and Caliban. It does force some changes in pronoun, of course, and I think Taymor misses an opportunity. She makes Prospera Duchess of Milan through her marriage. While I get why, it feels like some of her agency, some of her power is diminished. Her delivery of the speech is fascinating, a kind of valedictory to herself. And as the story progresses, she seems more and more fatigued, almost to the point that when the end comes, she's ready to release Caliban, drown her books, and toss her staff to the bottom of the sea. Maybe this is why Prospero doesn't deliver the epilogue. Instead, it appears as a song over the final credits, which did not work for me. As did, not, I guess, the portrayal of Ariel and the absolutely yawn-inducing relationship between Miranda and Ferdinand. Molina and Brand are excellent as the drunken buffoons. There is a certain normal cadence to Brand's delivery that is both naturalistic and completely understandable, and the villainous interplay between Cooper and Cumming is both comedic and cruel. So, for me, this is a definite watch. It's not as good as the Stratford one with Christopher Plummer, but one that I think is very much worth your time. Now, to finish off, we have two related videos. The first is Shakespeare Uncovered, The Tempest with Trevor Nunn, an hour special from PBS hosted by the famed British director focusing on this last romance. As with all these specials, what I like about them is their glimpse into the performance history of the play. I didn't know that Ralph Fiennes played Prospero in 2012. I totally buy Nunn's assertion that this is Shakespeare's most ambitious and radical play, a kind of experiment, one in which Shakespeare himself might have played Prospero. Maybe, but I see that as kind of hopeful conjecture. It also hits many of the high points I have or will discuss during my time with the play. Historical background, geography, the concept of Prospero as stage manager, Caliban, and colonialism. It also pointed me in the direction that I hadn't really thought about, the use of the indoor Blackfriars Theater and the idea that Shakespeare's audience would have had a greater suspension of disbelief on Prospero's magic, since many in that audience would have believed magic to be a real thing. And if you've read my past video reviews of Shakespearean adaptions by Nunn, you'll remember that I'm not typically a fan. I find his Shakespeare stuff pretty ponderous, even the comedies. And here, I'm not sure I buy all of his conjectures. Prospero is 50 years old, Ferdinand is a playboy. And if the play is being produced in the Blackfriars, then why would the Great Globe itself necessarily have been a reference to the Globe Theater, making this speech a valedictory? Those quibbles aside, anyone looking for a good overview of the background of the play, having already read it, would find this to be the right video at the right time. Now, our last piece is 1956 sci-fi classic Forbidden Planet. Since I was a teenager, I've heard how Forbidden Planet is The Tempest. Now, I've seen it, but I don't see it. I mean, I get it, totally get how Throne of Blood is Macbeth and Lion King is Hamlet, sorta. But for me, at least, Forbidden Planet is barely The Tempest, if at all. Yes, there's a father and daughter stranded in a remote location, the titular planet. Yes, there's an aerial analog, or is that a Caliban analog, or both, in Robbie the Robot. And yes, we do get a couple, literally, of comic scenes with the spaceship crew's cook and Robbie and liquor, thus the Caliban connection. But that's about it. Given the plot starts with a mission to search for survivors of a mission from 20 years earlier, from whom nothing has been heard, there's no sense of a previous usurpation of the Prospero character. Here, a philologist named Morbius, played by Walter Pidgeon. Thus, the element of revenge, and later forgiveness, is removed from the thematic elements, the loss of which kills any true connection to the play, at least in my head. Even the aerial analog is questionable. This robot with absolute selfless obedience is one that Morbius built, not one that he found. Now, I'm supposing that in the mid-50s, this was pretty cool sci-fi. Now, however, it's dated to the point of camp. I can see why it's so ripe for parody, like the stage musical comedy Return to the Forbidden Planet. It's casual when America was great sexism is a tad disconcerting. Morbius's daughter, Altara, a pretty and pretty vacant Anne Francis, gets passed around for ogling and kissing so much I began to wonder if this was more a Troilus and Cressida analog than one for The Tempest. As a movie fan, this was fascinating viewing, though. The bright Eastman color palette and widescreen CinemaScope vista was impressive. And seeing Leslie Nielsen, someone who is now the epitome of comic self-mockery, in a straight heroic role was fun, as was Earl Holliman as the aforementioned cook. But fascination alone doesn't make for a great Shakespearean adaptation, and I really can't recommend this. But I do have to give writers Irving Bloch and Alan Adler and director Fred M. Wilcox props for doing one thing. The creation of an id-fueled big bad in the plot does make me wonder if there isn't grist for a true production of The Tempest, in which Prospero's id is what's driving his revenge, a warped ego calling for the enslavement of Ariel and Caliban, with his superego restoring the balance, and thus forgiveness at the end. So, a review of our reviews. 1979/80 BBC, see it, especially if you're a completist. Either for the play or the BBC series. 1983 Bard Productions, skip it. 2010 Stratford, go out of your way to find this one. 2010 Taymor Film, another definite yes. PBS Shakespeare Uncovered, another yes, especially if you're looking for a good overview with background info. And 1956 Forbidden Planet, skip it. Shakespeare fans, need a poster to hang in your room? Teachers, need some nifty handouts for your students to peruse as you introduce them to the Bard? Or are you just in the mood for some printable versions of some of the cool infographics found on this website? Well, regardless of how you answered those questions, I've got a scratch for that itch, a solution for that problem. Check out the Bill Shakespeare Project page on the Teachers Pay Teachers website. You can find character maps for Romeo and Juliet and Julius Caesar, previewing the characters and their relationships to one another. I've also got geographical maps so your students can wrap their heads around travels within the plays Troilus and Cressida. Yes, even TNC gets some love. All's Well That Ends Well as well. See what I did there. Plus Pericles and Othello. There's also handouts on the so-called history in Macbeth and Julius Caesar, time in Romeo and Juliet, and violence in Titus Andronicus. Also, you'll find entire packets of handouts for both King Lear and Macbeth, including scene-by-scene timelines and the interactions as well as relationships between the characters. And I'll be adding even more soon. Plus, this is where you can find the printable version of the new and improved periodic table of Shakespeare. Some of these are for free, and some are for purchase, but all can be found on the Bill Shakespeare Project page on teacherspayteachers.com. Oh, and if you want to purchase a pre-printed poster-sized version of that periodic table, well then head on over to the Bill Shakespeare Project page on redbubble.com. Links to both of these sites can be found in the left-hand margin of this website. Now let's take a couple of minutes to discuss two speeches by what I find to be the most fascinating character in the play, Caliban. It's such a bizarre character, one that it seems Shakespeare himself doesn't know how to present. Not human, and yet poetical when he isn't planning to, you know, murder, usurp, or rape. Now, when we first find Caliban, Prospero and Miranda wake him. For what? I'm not quite sure. All I do know is that insults are hurled at Caliban, and he shows reluctance to show himself to Prospero. When he does show up, he curses them, to which Prospero promises punishments that evening. And then Caliban responds, "I must eat my dinner. This island's mine by Sycorax, my mother, which thou takest from me. When thou camest first, thou strokest me and made much of me, wouldst give me water with berries in it, and teach me how to name the bigger light, and how the less that burn by day and night. And then I loved thee, and showed thee all the qualities of the isle, the fresh springs, brine pits, barren places, and fertile. Cursed be I that I did so. All the charms of Sycorax, toads, beetles, bats, light on you, for I am all the subjects that you have, which first was mine own king. And here you stymie in this hard rock, whilst you do keep from me the rest of the island." Now, the words of the speech are pretty straightforward. He recounts how the island is his, passed on to him by his mother Sycorax. Prospero stole the island, however, even after treating Caliban nicely at first, petting him, giving him water flavored by fruits, and teaching him all about the stars. Caliban reciprocated, showing the magician all the qualities of the isle, and he curses himself for doing so, and then curses Prospero as well, reminding him that Caliban is his only subject, whom Prospero has confined in a cave. So yeah, the words are great, but what's interesting to me, and you knew this was coming, is in the scansion. The first partial line completes, without a rhythmical break, Prospero's line. What is to make of this perfect antilab? Is there an equation being drawn here? I might say that it is to show their differences. Caliban's line ends with a feminine added syllable. Feminine endings can also spotlight a mind too full of ideas, Hamlet, or mind, motion, soul diseased, as it can throw off the rhythm of the next line. Like I said, I would say that's to show the differences between the two, but I really can't. Prospero's partial line too ends with a feminine unstressed syllable, so I'm back to more of a comparison than a contrast. Another bit of scansion-y interest is, of the 15 lines, only 3 are perfect iambic pentameter, and 2 of them are separated by a single line. To name the bigger light and how the less, and then, and showed thee all the qualities of the isle. Again, this gives us a parallel between Prospero, who taught Caliban the names of the stars, and Caliban, who showed Prospero all the good things the island had to offer. The only other perfectly iambic line comes near the end. For I am all the subjects that you have. In it, Caliban discusses his rule, or rather, Prospero's rule over him. Now, there are a couple of lines that are iambic, but with that extra unstressed syllable at the end, the feminine ending. The first and penultimate full lines of the speech, "This island's mine by Sycorax, my mother," and "Which first was mine own king, and here you sty me." In both these lines, he touches upon his ownership of the island. One could argue that this explains his too many thoughts in his head, you know, the feminine ending. In the rest of the speech, save for one line, we get a trochee here, a spondee there. Only two lines have both. One comes near the center of the speech. "Cursed be I that did so, all the charms." And the self-cursing and the beginning of cursing Prospero completely fits this off-rhythm, heart-palpitating outburst. But it's the other line that I think really tears Caliban from the inside. "Which thou takest from me when thou camest first." This is the line where the actual accusation of usurpation takes place. 9 syllables, so we can expect a caesura. And it comes where we would expect it, at the punctuation between sentences. The second sentence kicks off with a palpitating trochee-spondee combo. He's upset, I get that. But it's what comes before that period that interests me. 5 syllables, alternating stressed and non-stressed. We could call it catalytic trochaic trimeter, 3 trochee feet, with the last foot losing its unstressed second syllable, or we could call it acephalous iambic trimeter, 3 iambic feet, but with the first foot has lost its head, the initial unstressed syllable. Regardless, it's weird, almost, you know, otherworldly, you know, like the witches in Macbeth. So is Shakespeare using the bizarre rhythm to equate Caliban with something more supernatural or subhuman? Maybe. Or maybe it's just a hiccup in the meter with no meaning. Sure, like that could be real. But let me float this idea. The meter that's there is messed up. Because the whole idea of usurpation is messed up. Usurpation is taking what is not earned. And that is what had happened to Prospero back in Milan. And this is what has happened to Caliban on this island. And so his heartfelt upset in the second half of that line, post-caesura, is earned. Caliban has earned this anger, just as Prospero has earned his anger and his desire for revenge, which drives our titular tempest. Prospero and Caliban. Yeah. Okay, so that was Caliban's first major speech in the Tempest. But now let's take a look at another of Caliban's big speeches, his oft-quoted "The Isle is Full of Noises" speech from Act 3. In Act 3, Scene 2, Caliban leads the two shipwreckees, Trinculo and Stefano, toward Prospero's cave, where he has convinced his two new masters, though that relationship is not quite master-slave, and he certainly follows Stefano more than Trinculo, so that they can kill Prospero and take over the island. Ariel, invisible to all, plays music which frightens the humans. Caliban attempts to comfort them. "Be not afeared. The isle is full of noises, sounds and sweet airs that give delight and hurt not. Sometimes 1,000 twangling instruments will hum about my ears, and sometimes voices that, if I then had waked after long sleep, would make me sleep again. And then, in dreaming, the clouds methought would open and show riches ready to drop upon me, that when I waked, I cried to dream again." As with that Act 1 speech, the words are straightforward enough, as he tells the humans not to be afraid, as the island is filled with noises. He describes music in both positive, sweet air, and negative, 1,000 twangling instruments. And he attempts to be comforting. Interestingly, there's not a single full line in the speech that's perfect iambic pentameter. 2 would be, save for a feminine ending, "will hum about mine ears and sometimes voices," and "will make me dream again, and then in dreaming." Now, there is an iambic line, but it's the final half line, "I cried to dream again," a sentiment, crying, that might easily be seen as one necessitating an irregular beat or two, and yet it doesn't. But this isn't what fascinates me, though. No, and believe it or not this time, it's not about the scansion. Now, let's compare this speech with a little old speech that comes just 2 scenes later. "You do look, my son, in a moved sort, as if you were dismayed. Be cheerful, sir. Our revels now are ended. These, our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. Another speech of comfort. Of what we sense, the former auditorily, the latter visually. A speech of dreams, of sleep. And of course, the speaker this time around is Prospero. Again, Caliban and Prospero. I'm telling you, there's got to be something there. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries since our last regular podcast, and that was a long time ago, you've missed out on subjects including, let's just face facts, you've missed a lot. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com, or become a fan of our Facebook page and our Twitter feed and our Instagram feed. Remember that these social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. Join us again for our next podcast when we'll continue our discussion of The Tempest with a little bit of body and some other stuff. Hope to see you then. Been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for January 7th, 2018. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.